call it tails. That should be a good random number generator. Working backward over the previous 10 sentences yields tails, heads, heads, tails, heads, 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 tails, tails. If our book isn't handy, don't worry. We carry random number sequences with us all the time. Take a succession of your friends' and relatives' birth dates. For even dates, guess heads. For odd, tails. Or look at the second hand on your watch. Provided your watch is not too accurate, no one else will know the current position of the second hand. Our advice to the pitcher who must mix in proportions of 50-50, or to the catcher who is calling the pitches, is to glance at his wristwatch just before each pitch. If the second hand points toward an even number, then throw a fastball. An odd number, then throw a forkball. The second hand can be used to achieve any ratio. To throw fastballs 40% of the time and forkballs 60%, choose fastball if the second hand is between 1 and 24, and forkball if it is between 25 and 60. Just how successful were the top professionals in tennis and soccer at correct randomization? The analysis of data in Grand Slam tennis finals revealed that there was indeed some tendency to reverse between serves to the forehand and the backhand more frequently than appropriate for true randomness. In the jargon of statistics, there was negative serial correlation, but it seems to have been too weak to be successfully picked up and exploited by the opponents, as seen from the statistically insignificant difference of success rates of the two kinds of serves. In the case of soccer penalty kicks, the randomization was close to being correct. The incidence of reversals, negative serial correlation, was statistically insignificant. This is understandable. Successive penalty kicks taken by the same player come several weeks apart, so the tendency to reverse is likely to be less pronounced. The championship-level players of rock, paper, scissors seem to place a lot of importance on strategies that deliberately depart from randomization and try to exploit the other player's attempts to interpret patterns. How successful are these attempts? One kind of evidence would come from consistency of success. If some players are better at deploying non-random strategies, they should do well in contest after contest, year after year. The World RPS Society does not have the manpower to record how each competitor does at the championships, and the sport is not developed enough so that others track the info. In general, there have not been too many consistent players in a statistically significant way, but the silver medalist from 2003 made it back to the final eight the following year. This suggests that the elaborate strategies do not give any persistent advantage. Why not rely on the other player's randomization? If one player is using his best mix, then his success percentage is the same no matter what the other does. Suppose you are the kicker in the soccer example, and the goalie is using his best mix. Left, 41.7%, and right, 58.3% of the time. Then you will score a goal 79.6% of the time whether you kick to the left, the right, or any mixture of the two. Observing this, you might be tempted to spare yourself the calculation of your own best mix. Just stick to any one action and rely on the other player using his best mix. The problem is that unless you use your best mix, the other does not have the incentive to go on using his. If you stick to the left, for example, the goalie will switch to covering the left also. The reason why you should use your best mix is to keep the other player using his. Unique situations. All of this reasoning makes sense in games like football, baseball, or tennis, in which the same situation arises many times in one game, and the same players confront each other from one game to the next. Then there is time and opportunity to observe any systematic behavior and respond to it. Correspondingly, it is important to avoid patterns that can be exploited and stick to the best mix. But what about games that are played just once? Consider the choices of points of attack and defense in a battle. Here the situation is usually unique, and the other side cannot infer any systematic pattern from your previous actions. But a case for random choice arises from the possibility of espionage. If you choose a definite course of action and the enemy discovers what you are going to do, he will adapt his course of action to your maximum disadvantage. You want to surprise the enemy. The surest way to do so is to surprise yourself. You should keep your options open as long as possible, and at the last moment, choose between them by an unpredictable and therefore espionage-proof device. The relative proportions of the device should also be such that if the enemy discovered them, he would not be able to turn the knowledge to his advantage. This is just the best mix calculated in the description above. Finally, a warning. Even when you're using your best mix, there will be occasions when you have a poor outcome. Even if the kicker is unpredictable, sometimes the goalie will still guess right and save the shot. In football, on third down and a yard to go, a run up the middle is the percentage play, but it is important to throw an occasional bomb to keep the defense honest. When such a pass succeeds, fans and sportscasters will marvel at the cunning choice of play and say the coach is a genius. When it fails, the coach will come in for a lot of criticism. How could he gamble on a long pass instead of going for the percentage play? The time to justify the coach's strategy is before using it on any particular occasion. The coach should publicize the fact that mixing is vital. That the run up the middle remains such a good percentage play precisely because some defensive resources must be diverted to guard against the occasional costly bomb. However, we suspect that even if the coach shouts this message in every newspaper and on every TV channel before the game and then uses a bomb in such a situation and it fails, he will come in for just as much criticism as if he had not tried to educate the public in the elements of game theory. Mixing strategies in mixed motives games. In this chapter thus far, we have considered only games where the players' motives are in pure conflict, that is, zero-sum or constant-sum games. But we have always emphasized that most games in reality have aspects of common interests as well as conflict. Does mixing have a role in these more general non-zero-sum games? Yes, but with qualifications. To illustrate this, let us consider the hunting version of the Battle of the Sexes game from Chapter 4. Remember our intrepid hunters, Fred and Barney, who are deciding separately, each in his own cave, whether to go stag hunting or bison hunting that day. A successful hunt requires effort from both, so if the two make opposite choices, neither gets any meat. They have a common interest in avoiding such outcomes. But between the two successful possibilities, where they are in the same hunting ground, Fred prefers stag meat and rates the outcome of a jointly conducted stag hunt 4 instead of 3, while Barney has the opposite preferences. Therefore, the game table is as shown below. We saw that the game has two Nash equilibria, shown shaded. We would now call these equilibria in pure strategies. Can there be equilibria with mixing? Why would Fred choose a mixture? Perhaps he is uncertain about Barney's choice. If Fred's subjective uncertainty is such that he thinks the probabilities of Barney choosing stag and bison are y and 1 minus y, respectively, then he expects the payoff of 4y plus 0 times 1 minus y equals 4y if he himself chooses stag, and 0y plus 3 times 1 minus y if he himself chooses bison. If y is such that 4y equals 3 times 1 minus y, or 3 equals 7y, or y equals 3 over 7, then Fred gets the same payoff whether he chooses stag or bison, and also if he chooses to mix between the two in any proportions at all. But suppose Fred's mixture of stag and bison is such that Barney is indifferent between his pure strategies. This game is very symmetric, so you can guess, and also calculate, that this means Fred choosing stag a fraction x equals 4 over 7 of the time. Then Barney could be mixing in just the right proportions to keep Fred indifferent, and therefore willing to choose just the right mixture of his own. The two mixtures, x equals 4 over 7 and y equals 3 over 7, constitute a Nash equilibrium in mixed strategies. Is such an equilibrium satisfactory in any way? No. The problem is that the two are making these choices independently. Therefore, Fred will choose stag when Barney is choosing bison. 4 over 7 times 4 over 7 equals 16 over 49 of the time. And the other way around, 3 over 7 times 3 over 7 equals 9 over 49 of the time. Using the formulas in our calculation, we see that each gets the payoff 4 times 3 over 7 plus 0 times 4 over 7 equals 12 over 7 equals 1.71, which is less than the 3 of the unfavorable pure strategy equilibrium. To avoid such errors, what they need is coordinated mixing. Can they do this while they are in separate caves with no immediate means of communication? Perhaps they can make an agreement in advance based on something they know they are both going to observe as they set out. Suppose in their area there is a morning shower on half of the days. They can make an agreement that they both will go stag hunting if it is raining and bison hunting if it is dry. Then each will get an average payoff of 1/2 times 3 plus 1/2 times 4 equals 3.5. Thus, coordinated randomization provides them with a neat way to split the difference between the favored and unfavored pure strategy Nash equilibria, that is, as a negotiation device. The uncoordinated Nash equilibrium in mixed strategies not only has low payoff, but it is also fragile or unstable. If Fred's estimate of Barney's choosing stag tips ever so slightly above 3 over 7, equals 0.42857, say, to 0.43, then Fred's payoff from his own stag, namely 4 times 0.43 plus 0 times 0.57 equals 1.72, exceeds that from his own bison, namely 0 times 0.43 plus 3 times 0.57 equals 1.71. Therefore, Fred no longer mixes, but chooses pure stag instead. Then, Barney's best response is also pure stag, and the mixed strategy equilibrium breaks down. Finally, the mixed strategy equilibrium has a strange and unintuitive feature. Suppose we change Barney's payoffs to 6 and 7 instead of 3 and 4, respectively, leaving Fred's payoff numbers unchanged. What does that do to the mixture proportions? Again, write Y for the fraction of the time Barney is thought to choose stag. Then Fred still gets 4Y from his own choice of pure stag and 3 times 1 minus Y from his own choice of pure bison, leading to Y equals 3 over 7 to keep Fred indifferent and therefore willing to mix. However, writing X for the proportion of stag in Fred's mixture, Barney gets 6x plus 0 times 1 minus x equals 6x from his own pure stag, and 0x plus 7 times 1 minus x equals 7 times 1 minus x from his own pure bison. Equating the two, we have x equals 7 over 13. Thus, the change in Barney's payoffs leaves his own equilibrium mixture unaffected, but changes Fred's equilibrium mixture proportions. On further reflection, this is not so strange. Barney may be willing to mix only because he is unsure about what Fred is doing. So the calculation involves Barney's payoffs and Fred's choice probabilities. If we set the resulting expressions equal and solve, we see that Fred's mixture probabilities are determined by Barney's payoffs, and vice versa. However, this reasoning is so subtle and at first sight so strange that most players in experimental situations fail to figure it out even when prompted to randomize. They change their mixture probabilities when their own payoffs change, not when the other player's payoffs change. Mixing in business and other wars. Our examples of the use of mixed strategies came from the sporting world. Why are there so few instances of randomized behavior out in the real worlds of business, politics, or war? First, most of those games are non-zero sum. And we saw that the role of mixing in those situations is more limited and fragile and not necessarily conducive to good outcomes. But other reasons also exist. It may be difficult to build in the idea of leaving the outcome to chance in a corporate culture that wants to maintain control over the outcome. This is especially true when things go wrong, as they must occasionally when moves are chosen randomly. While some people understand that a football coach has to fake a punt once in a while in order to keep the defense honest, a similarly risky strategy in business can get you fired if it fails. But the point isn't that the risky strategy will always work, but rather that it avoids the danger of set patterns and predictability. One application in which mixed strategies improve business performance is price discount coupons. Companies use these to build market share. The idea is to attract new customers without giving the same discount to your existing market. If competitors simultaneously offer coupons, then customers don't have any special incentive to switch brands. Instead, they stay with their current brand and take the discount. Only when one company offers coupons while the others don't are new customers attracted to try the product. The price coupon game for competitors such as Coke and Pepsi is then analogous to the coordination problem of the hunters. Each company wants to be the only one to give coupons, just as Fred and Barney each want to choose his own favored hunting ground. But if they try to do this simultaneously, the effects cancel out and both are worse off. One solution would be to follow a predictable pattern of offering coupons every 6 months, and the competitors could learn to alternate. The problem with this approach is that when Coke predicts Pepsi is just about to offer coupons, Coke should step in first to preempt. The only way to avoid preemption is to keep the element of surprise that comes from using a randomized strategy. Of course, independent randomization runs the risk of mistakes, exactly as in our story of the Stone Age hunters Fred and Barney. Competitors can do much better by cooperating instead, and there is strong statistical evidence that Coke and Pepsi reached just such a cooperative solution. There was a span of 52 weeks in which Coke and Pepsi each offered price promotions for 26 weeks, without any overlap. If each was choosing to run a promotion in any 1 week at random with a 50% chance, and choosing this independently of the other, the chance of there being zero overlaps is 1 over 49591853294810 4, or about 1 in 500 trillion. This was such a startling finding that it made its way to the media, including the CBS program 60 Minutes. The purpose of the coupons is to expand market share. But each firm realizes that to be successful, it has to offer promotions when the other is not offering similar promotions. The strategy of randomly choosing weeks for promotion offers may have the intention of catching the other off guard. But when both firms are following similar strategies, there are many weeks when both offer promotions. In those weeks, their campaigns will merely cancel each other out. Neither firm increases its share, and both make a lower profit. The strategies thus create a prisoner's dilemma. The firms, being in an ongoing relationship, recognize that both can do better by resolving the dilemma. The way to do this is for each company to take a turn at having the lowest price, and then, once the promotion ends, everyone goes back to their regular brands. That is just what they did. There are other cases in which businesses must avoid set patterns and predictability. Some airlines offer discount tickets to travelers who are willing to buy tickets at the last minute. But they won't tell you how many seats are left in order to help you estimate the chances of success. If last-minute ticket availability were more predictable, then there would be a much greater possibility of exploiting the system, and the airline would lose more of their otherwise regular paying customers. The most widespread use of randomized strategies in business is to motivate compliance at a lower monitoring cost. This applies to everything from tax audits to drug testing to parking meters. It also explains why the punishment should not necessarily fit the crime. The typical fine for illegal parking at a meter is many times the meter fee. If the meter rate is $1 per hour, Would a fine of $1.01 suffice to keep people honest? It would, provided the traffic police were sure to catch you each time you parked without putting money in the meter. Such enforcement would be very costly. The salaries of the traffic wardens would be the largest item, but the cost of administering the collection mechanism needed to keep the policy credible would be quite substantial too. Instead, the authorities use an equally effective and less costly strategy, namely to have larger fines and relax the enforcement efforts. When the fine is $25, a 1 in 25 risk of being caught is enough to keep you honest. A much smaller police force will do the job, and the fines collected will come closer to covering the administrative costs. This is another instance of the usefulness of mixed strategies. It is similar to the soccer example in some ways, and different in other respects. Once again, the authorities choose a random strategy because it is better than any systematic action. No enforcement at all would mean misuse of scarce parking places, and a 100% enforcement would be too costly. However, the other side, the parking public, does not necessarily have a random strategy. In fact, the authorities want to make the enforcement probability and the fine large enough to induce the public to comply with the parking regulations. Random drug testing has many of the same features as parking meter enforcement. It is too time-consuming and costly to test every employee every day for evidence of drug use. It is also unnecessary. Random testing will uncover those who are unable to work drug-free and discourage others from recreational use. Again, the probability of detection is small, but the fine, when caught, is high. This is one of the problems with the IRS audit strategy. The penalties are small given the chances of getting caught. When enforcement is random, it must be that the punishment is worse than the crime. The rule should be that the expected punishment should fit the crime, where expectation is in the statistical sense, taking into account the chance of being caught. Those hoping to defeat enforcement can also use random strategies to their benefit. They can hide the true crime in the midst of many false alarms or decoys, and the enforcer's resources become spread too thin to be effective. For example, an air defense must be able to destroy nearly 100% of all incoming missiles. A cost-effective way of defeating the air defense is for the attacker to surround the real missile with a bodyguard of decoys. It is much cheaper to build a decoy missile than the real thing. Unless the defender can perfectly distinguish among them, he will be required to stop all incoming missiles, real and fake. The practice of shooting dud shells began in World War II, not by the intentional design of building decoy missiles, but as a response to the problem of quality control. The elimination of defective shells in production is expensive. Someone got the idea then of manufacturing duds and shooting them on a random basis. A military commander cannot afford to have a delayed time bomb buried under his position, and he never knew which was which. The bluff made him work at every unexploded shell that came over. When the cost of defense is proportional to the number of missiles that must be shot down, attackers can make this enforcement cost unbearably high. This problem is one of the major challenges in the design of the Star Wars defense. It may have no solution. How to find mixed strategy equilibria. Many readers will be content to understand mixed strategies at a qualitative conceptual level and leave the calculation of the actual numbers to a computer program which can handle mixed strategies when each player has any number of pure strategies, some of which may not even be used in the equilibrium. These readers can skip the rest of this chapter without any loss of continuity. But for those readers who know a little high school algebra and geometry and want to know more about the method of calculation, we provide a few details. First, consider the algebraic method. The proportion of left in the kicker's mixture is the unknown we want to solve for. Call it x. This is a fraction. So the proportion of right is 1 minus x. The success rate of the mixture against the goalie's left is 58x plus 93 times 1 minus x equals 93 minus 35x%. And that against the goalie's right is 95x plus 70 times 1 minus x equals 70 plus 25x. For these two to be equal, 93 minus 35x equals 70 plus 25x, or 23 equals 60x, or x equals 23 over 60 equals 0.383. We can also find the solution graphically by showing the consequences of various mixes in a chart. The fraction of times left figures in the kicker's mixture, which we have labeled x, goes horizontally from 0 to 1. For each of these mixtures, one of the two lines shows the kicker's success rate when the goalie chooses his pure strategy, left, L, and the other shows the kicker's success rate when the goalie chooses his pure strategy, right, R. The former line starts at the height 93, namely the value of the expression 93 minus 35x when x equals 0, and descends to 58, the value of the same expression when x equals 1. The latter line starts at the vertical position of 70, namely the value of the expression 70 plus 25x when x equals 0, and rises to 95, the value of the same expression when x equals 1. The goalie wants to keep the kicker's success rate as low as possible. Therefore, if the composition of the kicker's mixture were revealed to the goalie, he would choose L or R, whichever gives the lower of the two lines. These portions of the two lines are shown thicker, forming an inverted V of the minimum success rates the kicker can expect when the goalie exploits the kicker's choice optimally for his own purpose. The kicker wants to choose the highest success rate among these minima. He does this at the apex of the inverted V, where the two lines intersect. Close inspection, or algebraic solution, shows this to be where x equals 0.383 and the success rate is 79.6%. We can similarly analyze the goalie's mixing. Let y denote the fraction of times left figures in the goalie's mixture. Then, 1 minus y is the fraction of times the goalie uses his right. If the kicker plays his L against this mixture, his average success rate is 58y plus 95 times 1 minus y equals 95 minus 37y. If the kicker plays his R against this mixture, his average success rate is 93y plus 70 times 1 minus y equals 70 plus 23y. For the two expressions to be equal, 95 minus 37y equals 70 plus 23y, or 25 equals 60y, or y equals 25 over 60 equals 0.417. The graphical analysis from the goalie's perspective is a simple modification of that for the kicker. We show the consequences of various mixtures chosen by the goalie graphically. The fraction y of times the goalie's left is included in his mixture goes horizontally from 0 to 1. The two lines show the kicker's success rate against these mixtures, one corresponding to the kicker's choice of his L and the other corresponding to the kicker's choice of his R. For any mixture chosen by the goalie, the kicker does best by choosing L or R, whichever gives him the higher success rate. The thicker portions of the lines show these maxima as a V-shape. The goalie wants to keep the kicker's success rate as low as possible. He does so by setting Y at the bottom of the V, that is, by choosing the minimum of the maxima. This occurs at Y equals 0.417, and the kicker's success rate is 79.6%. The equality of the kicker's maximum of minima, maximin, and the goalie's minimum of maxima, minimax, is just von Neumann and Morgenstern's minimax theorem in action. Perhaps more accurately, it should be called the maximin equals minimax theorem, but the common name is shorter and easier to remember. Surprising changes in mixtures. Even within the domain of zero-sum games, mixed strategy equilibria have some seemingly strange properties. Return to the soccer penalty kick, and suppose the goalie improves his skill at saving penalties struck to the natural right side, so the kicker's success rate there goes down from 70% to 60%. What does this do to the goalie's mixture probabilities? We get the answer by shifting the relevant line in the graph. We see that the goalie's use of left in his equilibrium mix goes up from 41.7% to 50%. When the goalie improves his skill at saving penalties struck to the right, he uses that side less frequently. Although this seems strange at first sight, the reason is easy to understand. When the goalie gets better at saving penalties struck to the right, the kicker will kick to the right less frequently. Responding to the fact that more shots are being struck to the left, the goalie chooses that side in greater proportion in his mixture. The point of improving your weakness is that you don't have to use it so often. You can verify this by recalculating the kicker's mixture in response to this change. You will see that the proportion of left in his mixture goes up from 38.3% to 47.1%. And the goalie's work on his right side skill does yield a benefit. The average rate of goal scoring in the equilibrium goes down from 79.6% to 76.5%. Upon reflection, the seeming paradox has a very natural game theoretic logic after all. What is best for you depends not only on what you do, but what other players do. That is what strategic interdependence is and should be all about. Case study. Jenkins Step Game. The scene is a sushi bar in downtown Tokyo. Takashi and Yuichi are sitting at the bar drinking sake while waiting for their sushi. Each has ordered the house specialty, uni sashimi, sea urchin. Unfortunately, the chef reports that he has only one serving of uni left. Who will defer to the other? In America, the two might flip a coin. In Japan, the two would more likely play the Jenkin game, better known in the West as rock, paper, scissors. Of course, by now you are experts at RPS. So to make the problem a little more challenging, we introduce a variant called the Jenkin step game. The Jenkin step game is played on a staircase. As before, the two players simultaneously cast rock, paper, or scissors. But now, the winner climbs up the staircase. 5 steps if the winner played paper, 5 fingers. 2 steps for winning with scissors, 2 fingers. 1 step for winning with rock, 0 fingers. Ties are replayed. Normally, the winner is the first to the top of the stairs. We simplify the game slightly by assuming that each player's goal is just to get as far ahead of the other player as possible. What is the equilibrium mixture of strategies for this version of the Jenkin step game? Case discussion. Since each step puts the winner further ahead and the loser that much further behind, we have a zero-sum game. Considering all possible pairs of moves leads to the following game table. The payoffs are measured in terms of steps ahead. How can we find the equilibrium mixture of throwing paper, scissors, and rock? Earlier we showed you some simple numerical calculations and graphical methods that are useful when each side has only 2 alternatives, like forehand and backhand. But in the Jenkin step game, there are 3 alternatives. The first question to ask is what strategies will be part of the equilibrium mixture. Here, the answer is that all 3 are essential. To confirm this, imagine that Yuichi never plays rock. Then Takashi would never play paper, in which case Yuichi would never use scissors. Continuing along this line implies that Takashi would never use rock, thus Yuichi would never use paper. The assumption that Yuichi never uses rock eliminates all of his strategies and so must be false. A similar argument demonstrates that the other 2 strategies are indispensable to Yuichi's and Takashi's mixing equilibrium. We now know that all 3 strategies must be used in the equilibrium mixture. The question becomes, when will all 3 strategies be used? the players are interested in maximizing their payoffs, not mixing for mixing's sake. Yuichi is willing to randomize between rock, paper, and scissors if and only if all three options are equally attractive. If rock offered Yuichi a higher payoff than either paper or scissors, then he should play rock exclusively, but that would not be in equilibrium. Thus, the special case when all three strategies give Yuichi the same expected payoff is what defines Takashi's equilibrium mixture. Let us suppose that Takashi uses the following mixing rule. P equals probability that Takashi casts paper. Q equals probability that Takashi casts scissors. 1 minus P plus Q equals probability that Takashi casts rock. Then, if Yuichi plays rock, he will fall behind 5 steps if Takashi plays paper, P, and win 1 step if Takashi plays scissors, Q, for a net payoff of negative 5P plus Q. In the same way, Yuichi would get the following payoffs from each of his strategies. Rock. Negative 5P plus 1Q plus 0 times 1 minus P plus Q equals negative 5P plus Q. Scissors. 2P plus 0Q minus 1 times 1 minus P plus Q equals 3P plus Q minus 1. Paper. 0p minus 2q plus 5 times 1 minus p plus q equals negative 5p minus 7q plus 5. Yuichi will find the three options equally attractive only when negative 5p plus q equals 3p plus q minus 1 equals negative 5p minus 7q plus 5. Solving these equations reveals p equals 1 over 8, q equals 5 over 8, and 1 minus P minus Q equals 2 over 8. This defines Takashi's equilibrium mixture. The game is symmetric, so Yuichi will randomize according to the same probabilities. Note that when both Yuichi and Takashi use their equilibrium mixture, their expected payoff from each strategy is 0. While this is not a general feature of mixed strategy outcomes, it is always true for symmetric zero-sum games. There is no reason why Yuichi should be favored over Takashi, or vice versa. In Chapter 14, Fooling All the People Some of the Time, The Las Vegas Slots, offers another case study on choice and chance. Chapter 6. Strategic Moves. Changing the game. Millions of people make at least one New Year's resolution every year. A Google search for the phrase New Year's resolutions produces 2.12 million pages. According to a U.S. government website, the most popular of these resolutions is lose weight. This is followed by pay off debt, save money, get a better job, get fit, eat right, get a better education, drink less alcohol, and quit smoking. Wikipedia, the free online encyclopedia, defines a New Year's resolution as a commitment that an individual makes to a project or a habit, often a lifestyle change that is generally interpreted as advantageous. Note the word commitment. Most people have an intuitive understanding of it in the sense of a resolve, a pledge, or an act of binding oneself. We will soon make the concept more precise in its game-theoretic usage. What happens to all these wonderful life-improving plans? A CNN survey reports that 30% of the resolutions are not even kept into February, and only 1 in 5 stays on track for 6 months or longer. Many reasons contribute to this failure. People set themselves excessively ambitious goals. They do not have good methods for measuring their progress. They lack the time, and so on. But by far the most important cause of failure is that, like Oscar Wilde, most people can resist anything except temptation. When they see and smell those steaks, French fries, and desserts, their diets are doomed. When those new electronic gadgets beckon, the resolution to keep the credit card in the wallet falters. when they are sitting comfortably in their armchairs, watching sports on TV, actually exercising seems too much like hard work. Many medical and lifestyle advisors offer tips for success in keeping resolutions. These include basics such as setting reasonable and measurable goals, working toward them in small steps, setting up a regime of healthy food and exercise that is varied to prevent boredom, not getting discouraged, and not giving up after any setbacks. But the advice also includes strategies for creating the right incentives, and an important feature of these is a support system. People are advised to join groups that diet and exercise together and to publicize their resolutions among their family and friends. The feeling that one is not alone in this endeavor surely helps, but so does the shameful prospect of public failure. This shame factor was powerfully harnessed by one of us, Neil Buff, in an ABC primetime program, Life, the Game. As described in our opening chapter, the overweight participants agreed to be photographed wearing just a bikini. Anyone who failed to lose 15 pounds in the following 2 months would have his or her photographs displayed on national television and on the program's website. The desire to avoid this fate served as a powerful incentive. All but one of the participants lost the 15 pounds or more. One failed, but only narrowly. Where does game theory come in? The struggle to lose weight or to save more money is a game of one's current self, who takes a long-run viewpoint and wants to improve health or wealth, against a future short-run self who is tempted to overeat and overspend. The current self's resolution constitutes a commitment to behave better, but this commitment must be irreversible. The future self should be denied the possibility of reneging. The current self does this by taking an associated action, being photographed in an embarrassing outfit, and giving up control over the use of these pictures to the program's producer to display if the weight loss is insufficient. This changes the game by changing the future self's incentives. The temptation to overeat or overspend still exists, but it is countered by the prospect of shameful exposure. Such actions that change the game to ensure a better outcome for the player taking the actions are called strategic moves. In this chapter, we will explicate and illustrate many of these moves. There are two aspects to consider: what needs to be done and how to do it. The former is amenable to the science of game theory, while the latter is specific to each situation. Thinking up effective strategic moves in each specific context is more art than science. We will equip you with the basics of the science and try to convey some of the art through our examples. But we must leave it to you to further develop the art you will need in the games you play, based on your knowledge of the situations. For our second example of changing the game, imagine yourself as an American male teenager in the 1950s. You live in a small town. It is a clear Saturday evening. You are with a group of friends playing games of rivalry to decide who is the alpha male. Tonight's contests start with a game of chicken. As you race toward a head-on collision, you know that the one who swerves first is the loser, or chicken. You want to win. This is a dangerous game. If both of you attempt to win, both may end up in the hospital or worse. We analyzed this game in Chapter 4 from the perspective of Nash Equilibrium and in the context of the Stone Age hunters Fred and Barney, and found that it had two Nash Equilibria, one where you go straight and your rival swerves, and the other where you swerve while your rival continues straight. Of course, you prefer the first to the second. Here we take the analysis to a higher level. Can you do anything to achieve your preferred outcome? You could establish a reputation as someone who never swerves. However, to do that, you must have won similar games in the past, so the question just transfers itself to what you could have done in those games. Here is a fanciful but effective device. Suppose you disconnect your steering wheel from the shaft and throw it out of the window in a manner that makes it very visible to your rival. He now knows that you can't swerve. The whole onus of avoiding the collision is on him. You have changed the game. In the new game, you have just one strategy, namely to go straight. And then your rival's best, actually least bad, response is to swerve. You are helpless as a driver, but that very helplessness makes you a winner in the game of chicken. The way you have changed this game in your favor is surprising at first sight. By losing your steering wheel, you have restricted your own freedom of action. How can it be beneficial to have fewer choices? Because in this game, freedom to swerve is merely freedom to become the chicken. Freedom to choose is freedom to lose. Our study of strategic moves will produce other seemingly surprising lessons. This example also serves to motivate a fair warning about strategic moves. Their success is not guaranteed, and sometimes they can be outright dangerous. In reality, there are delays in action and observation. In chicken, what if your rival gets the same idea, and each of you simultaneously sees the other's steering wheel flying through the air? Too late. Now you are headed helplessly toward a crash. So try these devices at your own risk, and don't sue us if you fail. A little history. People and nations have made commitments, threats, and promises for millennia. They have intuitively recognized the importance of credibility in such actions. They have used such strategies and devised counter-strategies against other players' use of them. When Homer's Odysseus tied himself to the mast, he was making a credible commitment not to be lured by the song of the sirens. Parents understand that while a threat of cold-bloodedly punishing a child for misbehavior is not credible, the threat, "Do you want mommy to get angry?" is much more believable. Kings throughout history have understood that voluntarily exchanging hostages, giving up a beloved child or other relative to live in a rival monarch's family, helps make their mutual promises of peaceful coexistence credible. Game theory helps us understand and unify the conceptual framework of such strategies. However, in its first decade, game theory focused on characterizing different kinds of equilibria in a given game: backward reasoning in sequential move games, minimax in two-person zero-sum games, and Nash in more general simultaneous move games, and illustrating them in important contexts like the prisoner's dilemma, assurance, battle of the sexes, and chicken. Thomas Schelling gets the honor and credit for being the first person to develop the idea that one or both players might take actions to change the game as a central theme of game theory. His articles in the late 1950s and early 1960s, collected and elaborated on in his books The Strategy of Conflict, 1960, and Arms and Influence, 1965, gave us precise formulations of the concepts of commitment, threat, and promise. Schelling clarified just what is needed for credibility. He also analyzed the subtle and risky strategy of brinkmanship, which had previously been much misunderstood. A more rigorous formal development of the concept of credibility, namely sub-game perfect equilibrium, which is a generalization of the backward reasoning equilibrium we discussed in Chapter 2, came a few years later from Reinhard Selten, who in 1994 was in the first group of game theorists to receive a Nobel Prize, jointly with John Nash and John Harsanyi. Commitments. Of course, you don't have to wait until New Year's Day to make a good resolution. Every night you can resolve to wake up early the next morning to get a good start on the day, or perhaps to go for that 5-mile run. But you know that when morning comes, you will prefer to stay in bed for another half hour, or hour, or longer. This is a game of your resolute nighttime self against your own future weak-willed morning self. In the game as structured, the morning self has the advantage of the second move. However, the nighttime self can change the game to create and seize first mover advantage by setting the alarm clock. This is intended as a commitment to get out of bed when the alarm rings. But will it work? Alarm clocks have snooze buttons, and the morning self can hit the button repeatedly. Of course, an even earlier self could have searched and bought an alarm clock without a snooze button, but that may not have been possible. The night self can still make the commitment credible by keeping the alarm clock on the wardrobe across the room instead of on the bedside table. Then the morning self will have to get out of bed to shut off the noise. If this is not enough and the morning self stumbles straight back into bed, then the night self will have to think up some other device, perhaps an alarm clock that at the same time starts brewing coffee, so the wonderful smell will induce the morning self out of bed. This example nicely illustrates the two aspects of commitments and credibility. What and how. The what part is the scientific or game theoretic aspect, seizing first mover advantage. The how part is the practical aspect or the art, thinking up devices for making strategic moves credible in a specific situation. We can illustrate the mechanics or science of the commitment of the alarm clock using the tree diagram of Chapter 2. In the original game, where the night self takes no action, the game is trivial. The morning self stays in bed and gets its preferred payoff, which we have assigned 10 points, leaving the night self with its worst payoff, to which we have assigned 0 points. The precise number of points does not matter much. All that matters is that for each self, the preferred alternative is assigned more points than the less preferred one. The night self can change the game into the following. Now, the payoff numbers matter a little bit and need more explanation. Along the upper main branch, where the night self does not set an alarm, the tree is as before. Along the lower main branch, we have supposed that the night self has a small cost, which we have set at 2 points, of setting the alarm clock. So if the morning self heeds the alarm and gets up, the night self will get 8 points instead of the 10 in the original game. But if the morning self were to ignore the alarm, the night self would get -2 points, since the cost of setting the alarm was wasted. The morning self has an annoyance cost of hearing the alarm. It is only 1 if it gets out of bed to turn off the alarm quickly, but would be intolerably large, 15 points, if it stayed in bed and the alarm went on and on, converting the pleasure of the bed, 10, into a payoff of -5, equals 10 minus 15. If the alarm has been set, the morning self prefers -1 to -5 and gets up. The night self looks ahead to this and reasons that setting the alarm will give it 8 points in the eventual outcome, which is better than the 0 it would get in the original game. If the cost of the action were too high, for example, if the night self had to set a timed incendiary device that would start a fire in the bed to get the morning self out of it, then the commitment would not be optimal for the night self to make. Therefore, in the backward reasoning equilibrium of the game, the morning self does get up if an alarm has been set, and the night self sets the alarm. If the cost of the action were too high, for example, if the night self had to set a timed incendiary device that would start a fire in the bed to get the morning self out of it, then the commitment would not be optimal for the night self to make. A more striking aspect of commitment may be seen if we represent this game in a game table instead of a tree. The table shows that for each given strategy of the morning self, the night self's payoff from set alarm is smaller than that from no alarm. -2 is less than 0, and 8 is less than 10. Therefore, for the night self, the strategy set alarm is dominated by no alarm. Nevertheless, the night self finds it desirable to commit to set alarm. How can it be good to choose a dominated strategy and not play a dominant strategy? To understand this, we need to understand the concept of dominance more clearly. No alarm dominates set alarm from the perspective of the night self because, for each given strategy of the morning self, no alarm yields a higher payoff to the night self than does set alarm. If the morning self chooses stay in bed, the night self gets 0 from no alarm and -2 from set alarm. If the morning self chooses get up, the night self gets 10 from no alarm and 8 from set alarm. If moves are simultaneous, or if the night self moves second, he cannot affect what the morning self chooses and must accept it as given. But the very purpose of a strategic move is to alter the other player's choice, not to take it as given. If the night self chooses set alarm, the morning self will choose get up, and the night self will have payoff 8. If the night self chooses no alarm, the morning self will choose stay in bed, and the night self's payoff will be 0, and 8 is greater than 0. The payoffs of 10 and -2, and their comparisons with 8 and 0, respectively, become irrelevant. Thus, the concept of dominance loses its significance for a first mover in a sequential game. For most of the examples we give in this chapter, you will be able to get the idea without drawing any such explicit trees or tables, so we will generally offer only verbal statements and reasoning. But you can reinforce your understanding of the game and of the tree method by drawing them for yourself if you wish. Threats and promises. A commitment is an unconditional, strategic move. As the Nike slogan says, you just do it. Then the other players are followers. The night self simply sets the alarm on the bureau and the timer on the coffee machine. The night self has no further moves in the game. One might even say that the night self ceases to exist in the morning. The morning self is the follower player, or second mover, and its best, or least bad, response to the night self's commitment strategy is to get out of bed. Threats and promises, on the other hand, are more complex conditional moves. They require you to fix in advance a response rule, stating how you would respond to the other player's move in the actual game. A threat is a response rule that punishes others who fail to act as you would like them to. A promise is an offer to reward other players who act as you would like them to. The response rule prescribes your action as a response to the other's moves. Although you act as a follower in the actual game, the response rule must be put in place before others make their moves. A parent telling a child, "No dessert unless you eat your spinach," is establishing such a response rule. Of course, this rule must be in place and clearly communicated before the child feeds her spinach to the dog. Therefore, such moves require you to change the game in more complex ways. You must seize the first mover status in the matter of putting the response rule in place and communicating it to the other player. You must ensure that your response rule is credible, namely, that if and when the time comes for you to make the stated response, you will actually choose it. This may require changing the game in some way to ensure that the choice is, in fact, best for you in that situation. But in the game that follows, you must then have the second move so you will have the ability to respond to the other's choice. This may require you to restructure the order of moves in the game, and that adds its own difficulties to your making the strategic move. To illustrate these ideas, we will use the example of the pricing rivalry of the catalog merchants B.B. Lean and Rainbow's End, which we developed as a simultaneous move game in chapters 3 and 4. Let us recapitulate its basic points. The two are competing over a specific item, a deluxe chambray shirt. Their joint interests are best served if the two collude and charge a monopoly price of $80. In this situation, each will make a profit of $72,000. But each has the temptation to undercut the other, and if they both do so in the Nash equilibrium, each will charge only $40 and make a profit of only $40,000. This is their prisoner's dilemma, or a lose-lose game. When each gives way to the temptation to make a bigger profit for itself, both lose. Now let us see if strategic moves can resolve the dilemma. A commitment by one of them to keep its price high won't do. The other will simply exploit it to the disadvantage of the first. What about conditional moves? Rainbow's End might employ a threat. If you charge a low price, so will I. or a promise. If you keep your price at the monopoly level, so will I. But if the actual game of choosing prices in the catalog has simultaneous moves in the sense that neither can observe the other's catalog before setting its own in print, how can Rainbow's End respond to B.B. Lean's move at all? It must change the game so it has the opportunity to choose its price after it knows the other's price. A clever, commonly used device, the Meet the Competition Clause, achieves this purpose. In its catalog, Rainbow's End prints the price $80.